Cincinnati is now in a very different situation than it was in 2002. The police department has improved its training and its policies and procedures, its investigations of uses of force and citizen complaints. The monitoring was to have lasted 5 years, but the parties agreed last year to add another year to make the transition complete. For NPR News, I'm Marianne Zalesnik in Cincinnati.
NASA says astronauts on the remaining shuttle flights will not be wearing spacesuits that are entirely safe. The acknowledgement comes after the agency released a report yesterday on the 2003 Columbia disaster that pointed to safety flaws in shuttle astronauts' suits, helmets, and seatbelts. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Music Shop and Pro Sound Center, now in their new location at 27 East Marketview Drive in Marketview Plaza, Champaign. The Music Shop specializes in the sales and rental of band and orchestra instruments, digital keyboards, guitars, amps, and drums, along with a wide variety of sheet music. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department offers box lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Delivery is available at 239-5632. Strawberry Fields also offers an in-store nutritionist.
This is David Inge. We're planning another cooking show and looking for hearty chili, soup, and stew recipes. Send your recipe by January 2nd to Chili, Soups, and Stews, WILL-TV, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. We'll put together a cookbook and choose several chefs to join Doyle Moore and me for a live cooking special in March. Learn more at WILL.illinois.edu. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. From time to time, we encounter large, unexpected events with the power to change our lives and, in some cases, with the power to change the whole world. Our guest for this hour of the show, Nassim Taleb, has coined a term for these events. He calls them black swans, and more about why black swans in a moment. But the basic point is that these things come along, they change the world, and then after the fact, we manage to find ways to explain them, to make them appear less random. And we do that because the idea that big world-changing events happen for no apparent reason makes us kind of uncomfortable. He says, however, when we do that, all we do is fool ourselves into thinking that we know more about the world than we do. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Nassim Taleb about some of the ideas that you will find in his book, The Black Swan. The subtitle is The Impact of the Highly Improbable. The book is published by Random House. We'll try to sketch out some of the basic ideas, and of course, if you'd like to explore them in greater depth, you can head out to the bookstore and look for the book. Our guest, Nassim Taleb, has been interested in a long time in the issues of uncertainty and probability. He has an MBA from the Wharton School at University of Pennsylvania and PhD in financial mathematics from University of Paris. He has taught at a number of places, London Business School, the Eisenberg School of Management at University of Massachusetts at Amherst and New York University. He authored an earlier book titled Fooled by Randomness that was published in 2001 and was very popular among Wall Street traders, a kind of activity he was involved in. He's also been in the financial world. Mr. Taleb, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Great.
Good. Thank you for talking with us. Let's just to eliminate any confusion or curiosity people might have here at the beginning about the title, the idea, the black swan. Basically, the idea here is you're suggesting that people think about swans, all those that they have ever seen, and chances are they are all white. You could go through your entire life and see 1,000 of them and they'd all be white. And from that, you might conclude that all swans are white. And the problem with that is what?
Well, before discovery of Australia, that was a prevalent belief because people had never seen a white swan, that absolutely a black swan. All swans were white. They had absolutely no justifiable reason to believe that swans could be of any other color but white. Mm. Till, of course, they saw that first bird in the new continent, you see. So my idea is that there could be exceptions out there hidden away from your observation. And we tend to think that because we haven't seen something, that it cannot happen. So I used that swan, that bird, as a metaphor for the exception that nobody really has in mind, okay, when they're conducting their daily business.
Yeah.
But my swan is not a bird, okay? It's an event.
Yes, right. It's an event, as you say in the book, it's an event of low predictability but very large impact.
Exactly. So I'm not just concerned by any exception. I'm concerned by those exceptions, okay, that are of massive consequences, and I believe, and that's basically a very aggressive position I've taken in the book, I believe that these exceptions run the world because the role of these exceptions is so large that not, although they're of small probability, although they're not regular, although they don't happen often, okay, they can play such a consequential role in what you're discussing. Let me take an example. Take the book business. Okay, you have 10,000 novels, literary novels, published about every year in the English language. And sometimes, some years, say 1997, five novels will represent 70% of the sales. I mean, this is the exceptions can play a very large role in, particularly in modern society, so you cannot ignore them, okay?
Yeah.
And likewise, I mean, take companies. You have 10,000 companies listed, maybe less than 100 companies sometimes represent more than half the capitalization. I mean, these exceptions, okay, what I call the rare event, the exception, the unusual, represent such a large role in so many what I call domains, you see, so many fields of inquiry.
There are people who make considerable livings predicting the future.
Yes.
And in many kinds of fields, I'm sure that there were people who could tell you, well, there are people who would claim to tell you what the weather is going to be like a year from now, what the stock market is going to be like a year from now. Maybe in the publishing business, they'll tell you what the next big hit novel is going to be. It seems that it's very clear in your argument in the book that you actually feel that it's not possible. And anybody who tells you they could do that is in fact, if not kidding themselves, they're kidding you, and they're taking advantage of your gullibility if they say, oh, sure, I can tell you what the stock market's going to do next year.
Yes, definitely. So what I said is and the black swan is the reason these people cannot predict. For example, the stock market, we know that 10 days of the past 55 years represent half the returns, the 10 most volatile days. You remove these days, you lose half the returns. So really, so the black swan is the reason we cannot predict what's going to happen. And let me give you a little bit of color on that.
Mm-hmm.
Take the world today, okay, how it is built today. We depend on three major technologies. The first one is a computer. The second one is the internet. And the third one, sort of connected, is a laser. Okay, three technologies that were not planned when they started, when they were implemented. Nobody had an idea of what uses we were going to have for them. Nobody really predicted the extent of the use of the internet. I mean, it was not designed as a tool to enhance the romantic lives of teenagers or people who have difficulties connecting in social settings. That was not the aim of the internet. It was a military application. Okay, The computer's main use, aside from the internet, is a word processing, not something to solve complicated equations. And, of course, the laser was not designed to do eye surgery and later on to help with the digital revolution. It was just discovered by someone who wanted to just have fun playing with light beams. Okay, so the idea that we can predict the future depends heavily on figuring out these black swan technologies that are completely outside the range of our imaginations. And effectively, they sort of like drive us. We don't drive them. And if you don't predict them, you're not going to predict anything. So the world is too crazy, and our imagination is too weak. So I tried to identify. I made a tableau in the Black Swan of domains, what I call them domains, in which the predictor is not really a predictor. And as a very simple test, would a cab driver access to a USA Today do better? Okay.
Mm.
And effectively, there are a lot of areas. Stock analysts definitely don't do better. Economists don't do better. And, of course, political scientists don't do better. But even when it's their specialty, even when they're tenured professors in a prominent university with a lot of publications on Afghanistan, that cab driver would probably have equal, if not superior, ability to predict Afghanistan. So this is sort of like the idea of the black swan. But in the black swan, I don't blame anyone for that. Okay, and in a few minutes, I can explain why I don't blame. What I'm saying is, hey, you know, let's identify the areas in which we cannot predict, and let's try to not depend on these experts for the following reason. If you listen to predictions made by a cab driver, you're not going to take a lot of risks. If you see someone wearing a business suit, a typically ugly business suit and white shirt and tie, making a prediction on CNBC or any of these, monstrosities, okay, you will probably take them seriously in your investment decisions and or take a lot of risks. Or if you hear an expert talking about Afghanistan who wears a suit and has like some hotshot title, you may take him seriously, and that is where the danger lies. So this, my idea is to identify the four experts so you avoid being swayed by the external appearance, you see?
Yeah. Well, I suppose that still begs the question, why anyone, when you could do as well by putting your money into a broadly diversified mutual fund, why anybody would give big hunks of cash to some portfolio manager when, in fact, they could probably do as well or better just putting their money into the S&P 500?
Yeah, I explored that in my first book, and the answer was not that. The answer is obvious to me. The answer it's not that obvious. What happened is that you may not be able to pick you may look at the investment manager and pick the lucky one, the one who had been lucky for the previous, say, 4 or 5 years, and think that his performance comes from skills when in fact it usually comes from luck, okay? Because let's say you have 1 million portfolio managers, you're going to have 2,000 or 3,000 with stellar performance, simply because if you have 1 million portfolio managers, it would be impossible in a purely random environment not to have 2,000 or 3,000 stellar performers. So you will go to these performers thinking that they're very skilled. That is one of the problems. But my problem with the black swan goes beyond. It's the fact that there are domains, there are areas in which nobody is a stellar performer, mm-hmm. Okay? And you need to know that or not depend on prediction. And there are things you could do, actually, to thrive in that environment by recognizing that it's an unpredictable environment, you see?
Mm-hmm.
Completely different. And how to benefit from an unpredictable environment by positioning yourself in a way where it doesn't cost you anything, okay? And you can make a bundle if you're right, and doesn't cost you anything if you're wrong, or cost you very little if you're wrong. You see, this what I call the wild randomness environment. But to answer your question, there is this: we are fooled by randomness. That was the title of my previous book. But there's also something else: is that traditionally in any society we have relied on specialization. There are areas in which the specialist is a specialist and the expert is an expert. Now, it's very simple. If you walk out of your dentist office and your teeth are still there, you look in the mirror and they're still around, you see, they're still in your mouth, all right, you can say, well, he's not incompetent. No? Mm-hmm. You can walk out of a restaurant and say, well, the chef is not incompetent. Okay? But, you know, if you have a robot randomly trading, okay, your portfolio, you wouldn't know it's a robot. You see?
Mm-hmm.
And there are some areas in which the expert is not so much of an expert, yet we still give him the same respect as we would to an expert who has evidence of expertise. So I have a tableau. Which areas the expert is an expert? Well, visibly the dentist is an expert in his area, okay? The chef who makes a souffle is an expert. You can identify his expertise. But a predictor, it's not easy to identify the expertise. You don't know whether he did well because of luck or he did well just because he made a lot of predictions and he's showing you the ones that played out, not the ones that failed. Or he don't know whether he did very well because he has huge insight and he is privy to the future, you know, and he's a different human being. So, kind of human being. So you don't know these things. You have less evidence in some domains, and these domains are the ones that are sort of socioeconomic, political forecasting, economic forecasting, stock picking, and stuff like that.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Nassim Nicholas Taleb. He is the author of the book, The Black Swan, The Impact of the Highly Improbable. It's published by Random House, in which he makes the argument that these kind of events, black swan events, we're not talking about a bird here, we're talking about events that have very low predictability but very large impact. He says these are the things that really change the world. They change our lives. And the book is about why it is we can't seem to accept the idea that things happen without a lot of good reason, often. Questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, let me move to that very question, and that is why it is that we find it so difficult to accept the idea that some things, and sometimes very big things, happen for no clear reason.
The problem we have in our brain, I'm going to change the question a little bit and say, why is it that we always look for explanations?
Okay. Essentially, yes. Why?
To answer your question by changing it,
yes.
I'd say because we are not machines that are made to understand the world. We are machines that are made to procreate and get out of trouble. Okay, so your brain is not designed to get to the truth. Your brain is designed to have a very quick representation of the world that would help you survive. So let me give you an idea. Say that there is something that vaguely resembles a lion, okay, around you. Okay, what are you going to do? Try to figure out if it's 1% probability of a lion or 50% probability of a lion, or is it really a lion or not a lion? What do you do? If you're going to sit down and try to analyze, okay, you're gonna die, and you're not gonna pass your genes on to future generations. Okay, so those who the minute they saw something that vaguely resembled a lion, thought that it was a lion, made that mistake and ran for their lives. Okay, are the ones who gave us their genes. You see,
mm-hmm.
So we tend to make a mistake of of seeing false patterns. Okay, all the time, and that has helped us in the past to see false patterns. Now, the problem is we're no longer in an environment where we have lions, and false patterns can hurt us, okay? So we are a pattern explanation-making machine that is out there not to understand the world, but just to get out of trouble, okay? And that worked beautifully up until, of course, we entered an era where information is more complex, and this pattern-making and explanation-seeking doesn't work anymore. But the way our brain is built, you cannot absorb information without some kind of a story or some kind of causal link between them. And that is a disease that we have. For example, I try to explain how the press works. In the book, I call it the narrative fallacy, why you always need to have a cause or something, even if it's not the right one, why you need to have some story in your brain. You cannot accept that things can be random, okay, or that we don't fully understand them. There's on a day when Saddam was captured, in the morning the bond market went down. So we had the headline on in the news on I won't mention the supplier of these news. Bond market down because Saddam was captured. Okay, mm-hmm. About 3 hours later, the bond market went up. Okay. So guess what headline we had?
Bond market goes up because Saddam Hussein was captured.
Exactly. So they cannot sell you information that's raw, okay? You have bond market down and you have Saddam captured, and they can only sell you information glued together with some causal link. And this is how our brain works. We try to make sense of the past. We try to make sense of our environment by concocting stories. Whether they're right or wrong doesn't matter. We just need a story. So in other words, you can't function without a map, and you'd rather go for the wrong map, okay, than any map. And that translates into a lot of things. I mean, look at the history of medicine. We always had medicine, and patently, okay, any simple analysis would have shown you which were the ancient sort of suspected. I mean, I'm not the first one to say that. Every 50 years, there's someone who says the same thing, okay, and it's been going on for 2,000-3,000 years, okay? And then you can read people doing the same thing I'm saying about economists, saying about doctors. They're saying, okay, you do so much better without a doctor than with a doctor because the doctor increases the odds of your getting worse or even dying, okay? So, medicine killed people until well into the 20th century, okay? So why is it that we still prefer to have a doctor than no doctor? Well, that's the way we're built, you see. We don't want to say, oh, things are not, we don't understand something, and either ourselves or society. Mm-hmm. So this is the problem that we have with events. So now, coming to answer your question, why is it that we don't understand very large events? Well, what happens is that before the event, we don't understand them. Okay. After the event, we try to concoct the story to make it look very understandable. And let me take an example: the Great War. Okay. Mm-hmm. When every single child who, you know, I was in high school when I learned about the Great War. Okay. And it was explained to me in the following terms. There was tension rising between the Great Britain on one hand and Germany and Austria on the other, and it led to that tension kept rising, and then there was a catalyst, and of course the war started, okay? Mm-hmm. And it was a very big war because tension was big. Effectively, when you read the accounts at that time, nobody was expecting the war. You had a lot of period, you see, but so after the fact, we're giving that. But effectively, the war was very unpredictable. And we can see that the war bonds did not expect the war. Tension between countries was something very common and developed all the time. In the previous 100 and some years, you had a lot of tensions between all these countries in Europe that usually end up resolving themselves with a party, a lot of champagne, and an opera singer, you see. So what happened is that it's not the tension that caused that, all right? In other words, it's that there's no hard link between tension and war, okay? The other problem we had with a great war is nobody really expected, okay, not just that the war wouldn't take place, but that it would take place, it would so deep, okay? We could not forecast the duration of the war. And since Napoleon, the only war that turned out to be predictable, really clean and predictable, was the First Gulf War. I'm talking about in a few hundred years, all right? Mm-hmm. So the world delivers events that are, for us, very hard to predict, okay? The world is too crazy, and we don't want to accept the fact that the world tends to be crazy. And if you want evidence that the world is crazy, look... Play history in reverse, the way it really ran, not the way our mind sees it. We see the event, and then we look for prior explanation. Look for history, and think of someone sitting at a cafe in 1913 in Vienna trying to explain what was going to happen for the next 5 years, okay? I'm sure that he would have been taken to a lunatic asylum, okay? Think of someone describing the NASDAQ rise in 1984. To an economist, he would definitely have been taken to an asylum, right? Same thing with the internet. Same thing with, and also the worst is not so much that the world is delivering strange technologies, it's the fact that the technologies that we think are going to end up running the world don't actually go anywhere.
I have some callers here, and I want to bring them in. Just let me ask you just one more quick question, and that is, do you think that in the future here, as time goes along, that we will see, either we'll see more of these kind of events, more black swan events, or perhaps maybe we won't see more, but their potential impact, their ability to change our lives, to change the world, do they get bigger with time?
That's the problem, is they have been getting bigger with time. Mm-hmm. Think of the Google story, okay? Mm-hmm. Think of the last two big black swan phenomena are Harry Potter and Google, okay? Think of, nowhere in history, you see something like Google, people going from college dorms to Google in such a short period of time. And where the dominant technology, Alta Vista, you know what happened to it, okay? That dominance, the road from zero to Google, and probably from Google to zero, is getting very compressed and very short, okay? The concentration is getting very big in the book business, for example. And cultural life is getting far more concentrated. It depends more and more on black swans. Same thing in economic life. So the world is getting more and more black swan dependent. You have fewer financial crises, but when they happen, they're deeper. Okay, and this is exactly the pattern of a black swan. You have fewer events of significance, but those that are significant are very, very significant.
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
So this is my answer. Now, one thing I want to mention about my book, before I take the question, is that I'm not saying try to predict or anything, nor am I giving. I'm delivering a very optimistic message of, hey, there is a very easy way to live in a world that we don't fully understand, provided we accept the fact that we don't fully understand it.
Let's talk with some people who are listening. By the way, maybe I'll just mention we're at our midpoint here. If you'd like to read more of our guest's ideas, Nassim Taleb is his name. The book is The Black Swan, The Impact of the Highly Improbable. It's published by Random House. We have several callers here. We'll start with someone in Urbana. We're here where we are. Line number one.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, having read your book and, you know, knowing that your book really revolves around outlier events for the most part, I remember reading in the early part of your book where I think you said something like, we don't learn rules, just facts and only facts. And that really drew my attention. I just wanted to, you know, get a comment from you on language acquisition. When I think of children learning language, I think a lot of what they're demonstrating is rule-driven stuff, not just facts, because, you know, they do generalizations such as, you know, feet for feet or past tense using teach for, you know.
That's a very good question.
And I'm wondering if you could just, you know, kind of put your arms around that one.
Yes, that's a very good question. Effectively, I differentiate in the book between two domains. One is the ancestral domain in which you learn rules, and the modern domain in which you learn facts. And effectively, children come into the world equipped with the right statistical intuitions. Okay, and I talk about, so I discuss that among which is the properties of learning, like the rules of language and stuff like that. We are equipped to learn from some in some domains. Okay. But not others. That's what I call native induction. Okay, in other words, a child knows immediately. And in the book, I explain if you show a child pictures of people of a tribe, okay, and tell them, listen, and the people of a tribe, hey, say, have dark skin, and you tell them, try to guess the color of a person who's not part of this picture, the skin color, they will say, oh, he has dark skin. But if they're all overweight in a picture, and if I'm trying to guess the person outside the picture that belongs to the tribe, they will tell you, oh, no, they're going to show a person of regular weight, okay? So there are areas in which we learn to generalize properly and areas in which we learn to not generalize, okay, as children. However, outside of that domain, what I call mediocristan, in which our statistical intuition or understanding of the world was formed, outside of that, we tend to only learn facts, not rules. In other words, like after September 11, so the people learning that they are black swans, as the unpredictable, you should take seriously if someone wants you to worry about something you don't understand. They just worried about people with beards and tall buildings. That was what they learned. Okay, just like the French in 19, after the Great War, they learned, hey, you know, the Germans can invade them from there and they'll build a wall, specifically from the area, you know, where the French invaded.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.
Thanks.
And that was the Maginot Line, and of course the Germans just went right around it.
Of course.
Next is Atlanta, line number 4. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
Great conversation, and I tend to agree with the guest on exactly what he says. And trying to frame this in my own life, I think I made kind of a mistake in trying to frame these thoughts as the fact that I've grown to kind of really rely on science to base some of the judgments I make in life, that which we all do. And I wonder how the guest thinks science fits into this overall argument.
And that's a very good question. Just like you have experts and pseudo-experts, okay, there are things we call science that are effectively scientific and things we call science that are effectively not scientific, okay? And while medicine itself went through phases where it was not scientific and now it became scientific, okay? So, and the cut line between them is there's something I call the narrative fallacy. That you know, just like you remember the story of that Saddam captured because, you know, the bond market down because Saddam captured, okay? Now, these sciences, I call them narrative sciences. And so which ones are the pseudosciences? The first one is economics and finance, okay? Political science as well. Things in which we don't have controlled experiments. We just base ourselves on the past, on the way what the past revealed for us, and making general statements based on these on what we observed of the past. Sometimes we observe an incomplete version of the past, and sometimes we observe a complete, more complete version of the past, but we invent the causal links that effectively are just accidental. Okay, and these sciences, I call them the narrative sciences. And then you have sciences that are experimental, like physics, where and effectively medicine is becoming extremely rigorous, okay, a lot more empirical and rigorous. And these are our sciences. These you can trust what they tell you to some extent, to a large extent. And so this is where I have the tableau. And it so happens that this idea of black swan, okay, tends to affect a lot more, affect us a lot more, not in the physical world, but in the socioeconomic world. And whatever science is linked to that socioeconomic world is going to be rather soft.
Yeah, very interesting. So common sense and a lot of things could prevail.
It should prevail. Okay, don't listen to my idea is that it's just like we shouldn't, and nobody we should learn from the experience of people listening to too many doctors in the Middle Ages. We shouldn't listen to economists today, all right? Or to someone working for U.S. government or any government making prediction of oil prices the next 25 years. Look at their past record in predicting, and you'll see. It doesn't take long to figure out that it's pretty much random, no more than it would have taken anyone long to figure out that no doctor was better than doctor at the time, okay?
Very good. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks.
It seems that at the same time that one of the problems we have is that, and it goes back to this question, is why is it that we want so badly to have explanations and can't really quite accept the idea that some things happen for no clear reason? That is, it is a very human tendency that as we go through life, we tend to collect data that confirm what we already believe, and not contradict it. And it's very difficult to cultivate a skeptical frame of mind that where you're constantly questioning what it is that you think you know.
Yeah, that's bingo. That's right. And I call it the confirmation bias. I have two things I discuss in the book that are linked to what you're saying. The first one is confirmation bias. Once you have an idea in your head, you're going to look for evidence that confirms it, not counter evidence. And effectively, this is where having a lot of information is bad for you, because the more information you have, the more theories it's going to produce. And once you have a theory in your head, it's bad for you. You see? So this is why you can put Democrats and Republicans, okay, in front of the same data, okay, and instead of converging, they'll diverge, because each one will look at his own confirmatory side of the story. You see? Mm-hmm. Now the problem, the more general problem, is that how the brain works. Our brain needs to make a lot more effort to suspend theorizing. Okay, then to theorize. And this is critical. That is the idea. If I say, before I die, if I had an idea, okay, that I want people to share with people, tell them, watch out, your brain produces too many theories. Okay? Mm-hmm. So the problem that we have is to suspend theorizing is costly in terms of effort, and you will forget to suspend theorizing. So this is why you should use this, what I call skepticism or suspension of belief. You should use it very, very sparingly. And you should use it on areas in which the cost, the black swan cost, can be monstrous, okay? Or missed opportunity also can be monstrous. So so thank you, yes, for pointing out that confirmation fallacy, how we like to confirm, and the general engine behind it, which is our idea of theorizing.
All right, let's talk with someone next in Chicago, line number two.
Hi, thank you very much for the discussion. It's fantastic. I read the first book when it first came out and loved it. And I'm in the middle of the Black Swan now, and I'm enjoying it even more. I'm in the money management business, and where there's been a lot of scuttlebutt about the practicing some of the concepts and perspectives that you talk about. Could you comment possibly on your experience and results managing money, particularly after 87?
Yes.
That was covered well in the first book.
Yeah, thank you very much. I discovered, after 87, I lost interest in, I was in my 20s, but I effectively discovered that the markets were run by accidents, all right? I discovered it by accident myself in late 1986. And so I realized that, you know, small events can cost a lot, and it was not priced in a derivatives market at the time, where you can get a disproportional bang. And there was a fallacy at the time called in beliefs of people thought that lottery tickets were lottery tickets, if you go buy them from a lottery company, all right, or state lottery, it's expensive, okay? People therefore thought that options in the financial markets would be accordingly expensive. You spend a couple of dollars to make $100, so therefore it's got to be expensive. Effectively, they're not, because a lottery has rules that I call it's non-scale. In other words, it has a maximum payoff, whereas the real world does not have maximum payoff. And this generated, after 1987, I started developing the theory I had called the Ludic fallacy, in the sense that most of scientific use of probability is based on games, and the real world does not look like games. The real world is a lot more complex than what I call the sterilized world of games. You see, when you walk to a casino, you know that the roulette table is not going to deliver, more than 36 times your bet, or whatever, 34, whatever X number of times your bet. You know it's not going to happen. In real life, you can get 10 million times your bet. You don't know, okay? You don't know the probabilities. The rules are not clear. They can work for you or against you. And the payoffs are unlimited. It's sort of like no ceiling to what you can make in some domains. And that no ceiling feature is the one that started obsessing me after 1987, you see? Is that some variables have no ceiling. There is a ceiling to how tall a person can be. Pretty much there is a ceiling. I don't know if you guys in Chicago can see someone taller than 8 feet. Okay? I mean, it may happen, all right, even in Chicago, or especially maybe, okay? But you'll never see someone taller than 800 feet or 800 million feet, all right? But in the financial world, I saw numbers go up. You know, the sky's the limit. I mean, look at the wealth of Bill Gates. Bill Gates is wealthier than the bottom 100-some million Americans. I mean, so himself, just one person, having that kind of disproportionate concentration of wealth in one the hand of one person tells you there's no the sky's the limit. Well, or close to the limit, or the close, you know, the limit is very high enough we don't know where it is. But in weight, you cannot have one American weigh more than 100 million people, you see?
Right.
So you cannot have even one person made in weigh more than 2-3 people. This is incredible, okay? 2-3 average weight person. So in the book, I made two domains. One I called Mediocristan, one I called Extremistan. Extremistan has this feature of the sky being the limit, okay? And in it, the contribution of the black swan is going to be monstrous. And I compare the two. And let me show you what the comparison of the two. To exit the finance and generalize it to the world. There's a chapter I compare the income for a dentist or a massage professional, okay, to that of a writer, okay? A writer does not have to be there. Like, I'm a writer now, and luckily, and that was completely unexpected. Okay, it's on my book is selling a lot of copies, all right? And I'm now talking from Random House offices. They don't ask me to come here and rewrite the book every time someone wants to buy it.
Right.
But a dentist has to be there to perform his service. So there is a cap on how many teeth a dentist can drill in his life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But there's no cap on how many books I can sell as an author because there's no physical. And actually, even if I die, Random House, they would love it if I died. It would sell more books, you see? So you don't have to be there to perform the service, okay? So when you separate these two, you realize there's a professional I call scalable, a professional I call non-scalable, okay? One has a limit, known limit. The other one, the sky's the limit. And that's what caused the Google effect. Okay, is that they are in the businesses that are running the world today financially, and are the biggest, the other ones are not scalable. When someone has an idea, leverage it to the hilt. With the bad news is that these scalable businesses, okay, the role of luck is much bigger, you see? Much, 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 much bigger. I mean, I'm in the book business. I see what happens. I mean, you have thousands of great authors. One of them, you know, has a book that starts taking fire. Now everybody wants to read that book and not the others. So I hope that answered your question.
Well, I was particularly interested in if you're still managing money and you answered my question and how you would be doing it.
Okay, I mean, I don't want my image, public image, to be associated with finance, you see, and my ideas to be embedded in finance. So this is why I try to avoid any specific questions concerning my own activities.
I understand.
You see, it's just simply that my finance represents, in that book, finance, what I say is like someone focusing on the financial applications, like someone coming to my house, and I'm proud of my library, that's, you know, and looking at the bathroom in the basement, you see.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many, I mean, my book is mostly, I mean, the dynamics of history and success and books and life and everything is the subject of my book. Finance is something I did to become an independent, and I don't need it now. But whether I practice it or not, I don't disclose. You see, but I just don't want. If I tell them yes, then people will focus on that to the expense of other items.
I'm going to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me. I have a couple of others, and we have about 10 minutes left. Nassim Taleb is our guest. If you'd like to read more of his ideas, his most recent book is The Black Swan, The Impact of the Highly Improbable, published by Random House. We have some other folks here who'd like to come into the conversation, and we'll next talk with someone here where we are in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Hi. How you doing?
Good.
I'm glad to hear this. This is really interesting stuff. I think it's nice to hear a little something along the guidelines of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, as far as I'm concerned. I want to find out basically what the difference between your theory and basic chaos theory is. Oh. Is there any major difference? Or
my theory is, I mean, my theory is not a theory. It's a conjecture that the black swan plays a large role, and it's mostly embedded in the philosophy of decision-making and how to move in the world. Effectively, chaos theory is sort of part of my book, particularly, some parts of chaos theory with huge differences that I use chaos theory as argument for unpredictability, okay? Whereas so many people use chaos theory as tools to predict, you see?
Right. Yeah,
so this is where my major difference is there, and I explore in it the consequences of nonlinearities in a world by showing, for example, why you can, by explaining why you can probably predict 2 months from now what the weather is going to be like, but 25 years from now, your error is going to be several million times the error 2 months, okay? Likewise, in anything, okay? Your error degrades too fast. So there's some rules I got out of this, okay? But I don't know if it's called chaos or so on. My argument is a little more empirical in the sense that in chaos theory they tell you, well, this is a mechanism. If a butterfly, you can have a disproportionate effect of an action. If a butterfly flaps its wings in Bangladesh, it will lead to a snowstorm in Chicago. All right. My point in a book is I go. It's a very nice story. But if I'm in Chicago, there's so many things. There are 10 trillions and trillions, all right, of possible things that can cause a snowstorm in Chicago.
Sure.
See? So what it's so-called the backward problem. And I use that argument for both unpredictability, for lack of understanding of cause and effect.
Right, right. So, well, you know, and you said, you know, something earlier about Google and Harry Potter being, you know, two of the major things. And you touched on weather. I thought, you know, global warming would be an issue that, you know, put up against this idea would be, how would you...
Yeah, okay, I'm asked a lot about global warming, and let me tell you my statement, okay? My statement is going to upset both sides. My first statement is a statement that in a book is of conservatism, okay? Don't mess with an environment, okay? As I'm hyper-ecologically right. conservative. That's my first statement. I wouldn't mess with something that works simply because that's my theory. It's just like my while eating stuff, I don't eat anything that was not that my ancestors did not eat in the Pleistocene. All right. So, but my other statement is I don't believe any of these projections about what's going to happen to the weather, because I think the degrees of freedom explode because for that reason nonlinearities, and I think that. I don't take seriously any projection of weather. Okay, I don't think, and I don't know whether we have caused global warming. One thing for sure, I don't want to pollute the environment. Okay?
Right.
So it may upset or please both sides. You see, I don't know, but I'm not doing it to upset or please anyone. It's just my position and the position in the Black Swan on predictability.
Sure, I understand. I guess politically, it's best to do it that way. I think the only question I have there is in. Then you kind of rule out ruling on the side of better judgment, just in case, you know, ruling on the side of, you know, so that you don't err.
I think the idea is you don't need to know who's right or wrong. You need to know the consequences of being right or consequences of being wrong.
I got you.
And this is exactly how I look at it in terms of decision making on uncertainty. This is why I still say, and in this black swan, I keep insisting, I don't like science, because science tries to understand the world, whereas I'm trying to manage in the world I don't understand, which is exactly opposite, you see, which is why my book, you'll find it in a lot of places in the philosophy section, which was my initial request, is that it's not so much whether global warming exists or not, it's what effect does it have on me, okay, that matters, okay, but I don't truly believe these equations, okay. All I know is that if there's a very small probability, all right, of these guys being right, okay, I just have to act in a certain way, you see.
So then you bring everything back basically to your own actions. You just, you know, a person then adapts to the world and does the things that they should be doing to make it a better world.
That's exactly it. I'm trying to make a map of living in a world we don't understand, and what are the things? And so I list them. There's things to benefit myself. Okay, I don't understand the world, so therefore there's some things that are believed to have limits don't have limits, so therefore I should have positive exposure to them. Okay, just like my book. People tell me when I wrote it, they said they had no chance of it being a bestseller because it's more sophisticated than books that became bestsellers, okay, although it's written in a funny style, all right? So, but now that it's on a bestseller list, you see, I think the sky's the limit. I'm not treating it as if it were an accident that it's on a bestseller list, because the world lives by accidents, you see? So the way I treat my life is I'm open to serendipity all the time, okay, while at the same time being paranoid about a very small number of things that can cost me big. And that's sort of the way to behave in a world that we don't fully understand. And also with a small dogma, which is I've inherited from the skeptics, there's a class of thinkers I dig out between Aristotle and the modern world that have completely vanished from consciousness. Not completely vanished, but don't have a lot of real estate in bookstores. And these skeptics, the idea of pure skeptic, you say, you know what, I go with customs, okay, as a default.
Right.
When I don't understand something, I go with the custom. And the custom of the elders, all right, not the custom of the modern, you see.
Right.
So I'm hyper-conservative in some areas, okay, and these areas, like ecology is the one, okay, in which I'm hyper-conservative.
Okay.
Likewise, medicine. I don't see a doctor if one in doubt, you see.
Okay.
These are the things.
All right.
Well, thank you. Well, let's go on to one more caller, at least, in Kankakee, line 4. Hello.
Your caller would wish to understand whether black swans are found in the area of ethics, and if so, or if not, what are the implications?
I have an ethical statement in the book. I mean, I'm a conservative person in the sense of, not conservative, political conservative, conservative in the sense that I take ethical customs as guidelines. But in the book, I have this ethical notion in Black Swan by saying that a lot of people effectively are violating my sense of ethics by partaking of some professions. Okay, I was in Washington, and I had a crowd in front of me of people who forecast for the government. And I told them something to the effect that you guys can't forecast, but why are you making us rely on forecast when it has huge standard error? Like, why don't you tell us that you can't forecast? This is your track record, and it's not good, okay? And then someone said, so why do you keep forecasting? And someone answered, well, I'm paid to do that job, okay? And I went into a rage at the ethics of a person who tells you, well, I may be producing something that harms society because they rely on a wrong number, okay? Just like a doctor who was prescribing something that may harm you, okay? But I'm saying no, because institutionally I am allowed to do it, okay? And actually it's my job. So my answer was, why don't you get a more ethical job, okay? And people don't understand my reaction. But this, to me, it is highly unethical to partake of a game in which you're producing something that people rely on and make mistakes. This is in the fallacy of prediction, which is part of my book, I have that ethical consideration. I think that's the main one associated with the black swan. And there are other ethical dimensions in it of how to behave in the black swan. And I say, in a world I don't fully understand, and there's a way to behave, because in the end, I'm a winner if I behave in a certain way, I cannot control outcome, I can control my own behavior, okay? And the aesthetics and ethics of my own behavior are my main driver, okay? So it has aesthetics and it has ethics component, and I'm going to judge myself at the grace with which I handle some things, okay? And even, you know, you say, okay, in a book I say, if something bad befalls you, show off, okay, with how you can, the dignity with which you handle some matters, okay? And also sometimes show off with the ethics with which you handle some situations, you see? So try to divorce behavior from outcome. This is my ethical component.
We're down to the point. We have about a minute or two left. One of the things you said as general pieces of advice of how you live in a world that you really don't understand, in addition to being open to serendipity, you said, well, you want to be paranoid about that small number of things that, if they happen, can cost you big. Now,
yes.
It seems like the problem with that, though, is that in one of our flaws, maybe as humans, is that we're actually really bad at assessing risk. We tend to worry about the things that are low probability, and we don't worry about the things where the probability is actually really high.
Or sometimes the consequences. No, but on my list is a very simple thing. It'll say, try not to be a sucker, okay? And my first rule is don't rely on economic projections, and don't rely on stock market projections, okay? Simply because people take them for granted, and they have absolutely no scientific nor any form of deductive validity. So this is sort of my idea, is don't put too much money in something based on past projection or stuff like that. I mean, I'm taking much more mundane and materialistic approach to that, to these small probability events, because I don't want to go back to work, believe me. And my portfolio is most of it is like 90-some% of it is in pure cash, and the rest is in very speculative instruments. But I don't want to have to go back to work, so I don't want to depend on stories about probabilities of a crash. I had no idea what the probability is, but I know how it affects me if it happens.
You mentioned the fact that there are certain areas, certain domains, the term that you use, that are where it's likely that black swan events can be really, really big. And two that you mentioned were cultural and economic life, and that's where we get our two recent examples of Harry Potter and Google. Are there other domains where black swan events, also you'd say, they could be really, really big?
Yes. Well, I mean, war, effectively, we're very good at predicting small neighborhood raids, and we're very good at small conflicts, local, like I'm saying, geographically local, like neighborhood conflicts and stuff like that. So it's coming from the days when we were primates and we were good at raiding. So we know the probability of winning a raid. We have no clue about war. Okay. So my idea is, again, conservative, don't disturb a complex system. Okay, don't wage wars. Wars have been unpredictable, both in duration, in depth, and probability and consequences. And you don't even know the link. You don't see the link between action and consequence. So I'd say worry about wars. This is why I'm a pro-peace person. I say even sometimes turn the other cheek, because really maybe the best thing you could do, right? Yeah. Because sometimes you may win. You don't even know who's winning wars, you see? So the link between action and consequence, it becomes so blurred, it's not even funny, you see?
Well,
so this is why I would strive for more peace.
There are many interesting ideas in the book. I would suggest people look at it. It's The Black Swan, The Impact of the Highly Improbable. It is published by Random House by our guest Nassim Nicholas Taleb. And Mr. Taleb, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot for inviting me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and many local news features, are available on our website anytime that you are ready to listen. Just go to WILL, that's will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering professional, licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates offers 4 area locations, including on the lower level of the Illini Union at the Oasis.
Think back on the news you heard on AM 580 this year. The primaries, the general election, the China earthquake in May, the economic crisis, and the governor is charged with corruption. And you're listening now. You've gotten a lot out of AM 580 this year, and now we're asking you to put something back in. Money to support the service. Your contribution's still tax-deductible in 2008, but only if you give today. Log on to willpledge.org.
This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. It's 1 minute before noon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Let's take a look at commodity prices on the last trading day of 2008. In Kansas City, March wheat trading at 617 and a half, down 4 1/4. May, 627, down 6. Chicago, March wheat, 596, down 8 3/4. May, 607, down 10 1/2. March corn, 396, down 1/2. May, 407 1/4, up 3/4. July, 418, up 1. September, 429, up 2. January beans, 954 1/2, up 8 3/4. March, 962 1/2, up 9 1/2. May, 974, up 9 1/4. July, 984, up 7 3/4. January meal, 299.70, up 170. January oil, 32.45, up 34. At the Merck in Chicago, December live cattle, 84.10, down 177 1/2. February, 85.45, down 45. January feeder cattle, 93.32 1/2, down 65. March, 93.25, down 57 1/2. February lean hog, 60.30, up 57 1/2. Outside markets, February crude, 38.9.